In the US, unemployment's at its lowest point for two decades. Wages are rising, the economy's growing. So why is Jeffrey Frankel so downbeat about the next recession? Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of conversations with the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips. Today I'm joined by Jeffrey Frankel of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Jeffrey, having read your recent blog on VoxEU, I think it's fair to say that you're taking a glass half empty view of what the next downturn's going to look like.
Well, hello, Tim, and good to be with you. Yes, you could say that.
Okay, you're not just predicting a recession soon, because I think probably now the majority of US economists are projecting one in the next year or two, but you're predicting that the next one's going to be particularly bad.
Well, yes. Let me say I'm not necessarily predicting when it'll be soon. I think it's extremely difficult to predict the timing of a recession, so I don't have much to say about that. My prediction is that when the next one comes, and there's always going to be a next one, I think it's going to be worse than the average recession.
And your reasoning on this is that at the moment, U.S. government policy is too pro-cyclical, yes?
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
So which policies are too pro-cyclical?
Well, three broad areas. It's kind of impressive, the uniformity of the pro-cyclicality, which of course means excessive ease and a boom is what we're talking about. So yes, absolutely fiscal policy, and I think many people are aware of that. I would also emphasize financial regulation, that we're loosening up on financial regulations at exactly the point in the business cycle when we should be doing the opposite. And third, monetary policy, although here I hasten to add, I'm not talking about the actual policy adopted by the Fed, but the political pressures that they're under from Washington politicians, which seem to be pushing in the direction of pro-cyclicality.
So let's dig into that a little bit and find out how that's come about. In fiscal policy, the big event in that clearly has been the recent tax bill, and that cut corporate tax rates. Surely that was overdue.
I do agree that a reduction in corporate income tax rates in the U.S. was appropriate, and that's not my quarrel with the tax bill that was passed in December. But an appropriate or genuine tax reform would have been revenue neutral. It would have been, while lowering the tax rate, broadening the base, getting rid of some loopholes and deductions so that you're not, you know, giving away $1.5 trillion of revenue over 10 years. Let me also add that it's not just the tax cut. There's also been a rapid increase in spending in particular areas. Military spending would be the big one. But also, they've more recently proposed some new additional tax cuts. And again, they're not going to be revenue neutral. I mean, they'll always claim the tax cuts will stimulate economic activity so much that they'll pay for themselves. But it's never true. Virtually no reputable economists, including the leading Republican economists, think their tax cuts will pay for themselves. They don't. And the ones this December, they're not paying for themselves.
And for many years, the deficit hawks have been influential in the way that fiscal policy has been decided, particularly during the last recession. Suddenly, has everyone decided that the size of the deficit doesn't matter?
Well, I mean, to be blunt, a drastic change in position on the dangers or not of fiscal deficits is not everyone. It's not all politicians. To be blunt, it's the Republican politicians who were screaming bloody murder when Obama did his fiscal stimulus at the height of the recession with the economy in free fall in 2009 and unemployment headed for 10%. And then when the economy's at full employment, then they change their minds. And of course, it's because they're in office. And this is not new. By now, the claim to fiscal conservatism has been thoroughly worn out. So, for example, when George W. Bush had his tax cuts, the second round in 2003, when the economy was in expansionary mode, Vice President Dick Cheney was quoted as saying, oh, don't worry about the deficits. Reagan showed that deficits don't matter.
And to be clear, at this point in the cycle, you believe that the size of the deficit does matter?
Oh, it sure matters. I mean, in the long term, it matters in any stage of the cycle. If the future path, the predictable path of debt is explosive, meaning the ratio of debt to GDP looks like it's going to be increasing without limit, that's always a serious problem, and that's the case today. But it's particularly a problem if you launch this fiscal stimulus, these tax cuts, and increase in spending at a peak in the business cycle, at a point when unemployment is already below 4%, because it means that you are limited, or at least you'll think that you're limited in your ability to respond when the recession comes along. You won't have the fiscal space, is a jargon term, when the recession hits. And the appropriate thing to do is ease up, and then it's time to run larger budget deficits and have some tax cuts and spending increases. But you will feel like you can't do it or shouldn't do it. And so that's the whole problem with pro-cyclical policy. It exacerbates the swings in the business cycle. And that's precisely the reason, in fact, the only reason why I'm predicting that the next recession will be more serious, because we will have already used up our ammunition on the fiscal front and also the monetary and regulatory fronts. In addition, if you really wanted to reduce the trade deficit, the most surefire way of doing it would be to cut the budget deficit.
Also, at the beginning of this interview, you said regulatory as well, that you have a very pro-cyclical regulatory policy. But that's very subjective, isn't it? Sometimes it's hard to distinguish useful deregulation, which simplifies and clarifies, from the bad kind of deregulation. So where precisely do you think the rollback of regulation is going too far at the moment?
It's very sharp of you to phrase the question that way, because you're right. It's not generally a question of, or shouldn't be a question of, too much regulation or not enough regulation. You want the right kinds of regulations. You want smart regulations. But I'll give you my list to answer your questions of where I think U.S. financial deregulation has gone too far, particularly in the last couple of years. First, blocking the provision which was part of Dodd-Frank, our financial reform bill after the last recession, blocking the provision that banks should add to their capital buffers toward the peak of the business cycle or the financial cycle, which is where we are now. We should be using that, but to the contrary, some politicians want to ease up on the banks, on the capital buffers. Number two is weakening stress tests. And I agree that there can be excessive compliance burdens, particularly on small banks. And the fact that they raised the threshold for the banks that are covered from $50 billion in assets, that's okay. But they raised it to $250 billion, which I think is too high, and it's letting too many banks off the hook. Then there's exempting non-banks from stress tests. And it's really the non-banks where the problems arose in the global financial crisis and might arise next time. Then there's reversing Obama's fiduciary rule, which they did in June. And it's almost unfathomable how you could say that a financial advisor advising a family on its retirement portfolio should not be required to give advice that's in the best interest of the client. You'd think that'd be a no-brainer, but they reversed that. And then the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was doing all kinds of good work, set up also under Dodd-Frank, not just mortgage debt, which was the source of the 2007-8 crisis, but on student loans and auto loans and payday loans. And then there were some things they did before, like gutting the risk retention rules for mortgage originators, you know, that said that mortgage originators had to keep some skin in the game to give them an incentive to make sure that a borrower could repay the loan. It's really quite a long list of places where they have picked regulations that were there for good reasons and were really protecting people and undermined them or removed them.
Yeah, just in terms of the legislative burden of doing that, that is an extremely long list, isn't it? What's caused it? Is it ideological? Is it the result of lobbying? Did the people involved not want this legislation in the first place?
Yes to all three of those. Ideological, lobbying, and they've been trying to fight it from the very beginning. And the original Dodd-Frank legislation that passed was already watered down in some ways. I mean, for example, the auto dealers got exemptions. And so, yes, I would fault ideology and lobbying and all that. But I also put some blame, if that's the right word, on the left, because there's been a widespread view that there's no difference between the two political parties, that Dodd-Frank doesn't really matter, and the only solution is to break the banks up into little bitty pieces or something like that, who knows. And that was never going to happen. If it did happen, it wouldn't solve the problem. And most importantly, there was not pushback. Each of these things I've named, and some of them have been going on for years. When they passed Congress, nobody on the left protested. I guess they thought politics as usual, or they had their eyes on bigger goals like breaking up the banks into the bitty pieces or something. So I think the lack of a political counterbalance is part of the problem.
Finally, if we look at monetary policy, you're not putting the responsibility on the Fed.
Right. Well, I mean, fortunately, the Fed still is an independent agency. Mm-hmm. So I think we have had good monetary policy, both of quite aggressive and in many ways unprecedented easing when the global financial crisis hit, which is reducing interest rates essentially to zero, and quantitative easing and all that when unemployment was above 9%. And then in the last couple of years, when the economy has fully recovered, I mean, not everybody or every sector has recovered, but in the aggregate, GDP and employment have recovered, where unemployment is below 4%, and it's appropriate for them to be raising interest rates. And so I think they've done it right. But what I have in mind when I'm criticizing the pro-cyclicality of some politicians is that they want to rein in the independence of the Fed, and they've complained about that. When unemployment was above 9%, they complained about quantitative easing. They said the Fed was being too easy, and they warned we were on the road to hyperinflation and devaluation of the currency. And now, that when unemployment is below 4%, now they're complaining about the increase in interest rates. So that just seems like completely pro-cyclical behavior. If you're opposing the easing when unemployment is 9% and you're opposing the tightening when it's below 4%, you got the timing exactly wrong.
But as you say, the Fed is still an independent body. And so is this just noise? Will it have any effect?
Well, I'm optimistic when it comes to the Fed. Unlike the fiscal policy issues and the regulatory policy issues, the Fed is independent, and I think they're doing a good job. And I will say that President Trump's appointments to the Fed have been highly professional people and have been good appointments. So I am actually optimistic, while always being cautious about that, but I'm optimistic that the Fed can retain its independence. We haven't heard as much lately of Congress bills to audit the Fed or rein them in some way or another. Now, that may be because they now realize that proposals they were making before, they were in favor of tighter monetary policy, and now they're not in favor of that, and maybe they're still working on some way of writing legislation that would force the Fed to have easier monetary policy. So we may not be done with this, and I have a feeling we're really not done with it from President Trump, because if there is this recession, his eyes may fix on the Fed as a good scapegoat.
Now, I'm conscious we're talking about U.S. policy only here, so are you concerned for the global economy, or is this really a U.S.-only worry that you have?
Well, of course, the U.S. is still the most important single country for the world economy. And we really saw that in the Great Recession, the global financial crisis, that what happens in the U.S. has big effects on other countries, sometimes bigger effects on other countries. I'm thinking of the European periphery, for example, the kind of knock-on effects. So certainly the whole world is involved. But also when you ask about what could cause a new recession, there's a number of possibilities, but some of them would originate in other countries, whether it's emerging market, like the problems Turkey is undergoing and the possibility of contagion from that, or Italy's problems now in Europe, or China, which has had a slowdown and has a lot of debt. So you could have causality going both ways, the shocks and the transmission going from the U.S. to the rest of the world or the other direction.
Does what causes the next recession affect how deep it's going to go and how wide it goes?
Well, my prediction about it being deeper than average because of the current pro-cyclicality, I'm making that regardless of what the cause turns out to be. In general, the answer to your question is often yes. The reason the last recession was so deep wasn't just that the fiscal stimulus was limited, but also the initial shock was so large because of the nature of the subprime mortgage crisis. I've been pointed out, for example, by my colleagues, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, in their book This Time is Different, that financial crises that originate in a crash in asset values and a disappearance of liquidity, that those tend to be initially deeper than others. And I don't necessarily see that happening this time. But if you want to speculate where a recession might come from, you can talk about areas of vulnerability. And those are in the asset markets. The U.S. stock market is extremely high, cyclically adjusted price earnings ratios are very high. There's just a lot of corporate debt and loan quality is down. That's not a predictor of a recession, but it's a point of vulnerability. And then where the shocks could come from, they could come from an increase in inflation. They could come from an escalation of the trade war. So any of these things are possible. Whatever it is, and maybe it'll be something that's not on the list I just gave, but whatever it is, you want to prepare for it by tightening the budget during the boom phase and tightening capital standards for banks and raising interest rates. You know, in other words, you should keep your powder dry for when you need it.
If I could make you policymaker for a day at this point in the cycle, is there anything very much we could do, or is it just a question of strap in because it's going to be a bumpy ride?
Well, I mean, on monetary policy, like I said, I think they're doing it about right. I wouldn't say they should be raising interest rates faster than they are, because that could precipitate the very recession we're worried about. On regulatory policy, I think there's serious mistakes. It should be corrected as soon as possible. But in terms of the cyclical point, it might be too late to do that, again, without, you know, precipitating the recession that you're trying to avoid. The area where, if I really were the omnipotent policymaker that you've nominated me for here, where I think we could make a difference is fiscal policy. If it were politically possible, and that would require that people refocus on the budget deficit the way they used to not long ago think it was such a problem, and particularly the long-run path of the debt-to-GDP ratio and the coming retirement of the baby boomers and the huge deficits we're going to start running before long in Social Security, our pension program, and Medicare. If people were focused on this and it was politically possible, absolutely be a good time to switch to a more sustainable long-term path for fiscal policy. So something like what the first President Bush did in 1991, which was set taxes on a gradually increasing path, nothing extreme, just mild, and then put caps on spending. He agreed that with the Congress in 1991. And then when Bill Clinton became president, he renewed it, this time only with Democratic votes, in 1993. And that is bend down the path of spending and bend up the path of tax revenue so that by the latter part of the 90s, we were running budget surpluses. So it requires some long-run planning. And if you can commit now to a path like that, you could solve the problem and create some fiscal space so when, over the course of the decade, you got hit by that recession, there was some room to respond.
Jeffrey Frankel, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you want to revisit these arguments, Jeffrey's blog on VoxEU is called The Next Recession Could Be a Bad One, and I think you know now where that title came from. This has been a Vox Talk, presented by the Centre for Economic Policy Research. You can find us on your podcast platform or at voxeu.org/vox-talks.